Hello, this is Medea.
Hi, this is Amelia.
Hi, Amelia.
Maria. This is Maria.
How are you doing?
Hi, this is Brandy.
Hi, Brandy.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is our final seminar, so I hope you all feel almost as smart as you had planned to be. So I want to, and I hope you've had a chance if you missed the last seminar because of the Memorial Day holiday to catch up and listen to it online. The recordings will be available for 30 days after our last day of class, which is today. I wanted to get your responses and questions. There are a couple of questions that were sent to me to respond to, but anything hot off the press, anything you'd like to talk about right now, or anything you'd like to comment on. Well, let me answer a couple of questions and then see what your thoughts are about those. One is about procrastination and change and why it's so appealing not only to hold on to change but to do last-minute things. Now, at times, we may feel like we do better, or certain people feel like they do better, with challenges and emergencies, even disasters, because all of those activate our brains. It gives us energy and focused attention that may otherwise be missing day to day and moment to moment. It's sort of like the person who waits on a deadline until it's imminent and then anxiously creates a flurry of pressured activity and can become habituated to this procrastination and the deadline process because they get habituated to a cortisol and adrenaline rush that boosts energy and performance, at least temporarily. So a negative excitement is still excitement. So that's how somebody can be habituated to put things off until a deadline is imminent and then do a grand flourish at the end. And I hope that makes sense. Another is to look at what seems elusive and why people are not reaching goals. Why the question was a little vague, but I want to try to concretize it. Let me try to concretize it to give my response and then see if we can make sense of the question. The most common reason you don't get what you want is the story of why you can't have it. The second most common reason, in my view, that you don't get what you want is you don't want the attainable. In other words, if your goal is more or perfect, that's not having a goal. Some of you are familiar with this. I did a study some time ago, and I presented it, a summary of it in The Secret Language of Money. When my first book many, many years ago came out on money, I did a number of presentations and did several hundred surveys of audiences comprised mostly of professionals and executives and sent around a card, an index card with three numbers on it. And I asked them, and I told them I would treat it with confidence, and they would, you know, seal it and send it back into me. What's the one thing, the one word first comes to mind that money means to you? So naturally, there are a whole range of things, you know, worth, love, esteem, power, freedom. Second question is, what is your current annual income? Present. And third, what would your current annual income need to be in order for you to feel free, happy, carefree about money, to feel that you really had enough? Over 90% of these many hundreds of people, and in a broad range of incomes, actually, felt that it would take about twice as much that they currently made for them to be happy and carefree and feel that they had enough money. So what this meant is, at that time, this was back many years ago, people who made $50,000 thought it would take about $100,000. People who made $100,000 thought it would take about two, same with $500,000 and $1,000,000. And in follow-ups, there was a trailing double. In other words, the people who were making 100. When they got to 200, they then thought it would take 400. So that really brings into focus what enough is, and about having a goal and having a tangible goal, because sometimes we get in the habit of, and this can happen, and I mentioned this just briefly in the first seminar, about looking at a new career and having all the anticipatory pleasure and how this brings about hope and dopamine response and all kinds of things, and we consistently set up a new series of things, and in that way we can make them all unattainable, because the process in itself is the stand-in for the real thing, whether it's money or food or a new relationship or a new career, because each of these is a promise never kept, but they keep hope alive and the anticipatory release of the pleasure chemical dopamine. So it's been said that, you know, I've forgotten the exact quote, but it's better to travel hopefully than to arrive. And this is the issue with extreme success, that people have a long anticipated pleasure or attainment that they finally reached, and then what now? You know, Olympic athletes, in fact, Bruce Jenner, said after he ran his last race, and he had spent the last decade doing Olympics planning for it, he said, "What do I do now?" He asked that the next day. So dealing with extreme success is difficult in itself. Instead of just ratcheting up to the next accomplishment, to look at what's good enough. So, other thoughts or other questions or other responses about any of the things that we have or haven't talked about?
Dave, when you just talked about, you know, the success, and it's interesting because when we went to California with my son, and, you know, there were some people that, you know, instantly became a star or whatever, and then, you know, we would get callbacks, but he wouldn't book, and then his agent said to us, he says, you know, the people that are overnight successes, it never seems to last. So this is a great progress, you know, of him getting callbacks is great, you know. And then I read the book Think and Grow Rich, and I totally understand, like, you have to grow into it. It's not something like you become rich and most people will just lose all their money. But it's a process that you go through,
yeah,
that, you know, helps you to keep it.
Absolutely. Keith Richards said, you know, fame has killed more guys than drugs and alcohol. This is the subject of an upcoming teleseminar series that I'm going to do about stress mastery and peak performance, because it's a book I'm currently working on. So stay tuned for that. A great yeah. Point. Thank you for mentioning that. Remind everybody who you are.
Oh, I'm Maria Turner from Georgia.
Yeah. Great, yeah. All right. Any other comments or questions? Okay, well, save them up then. I want to save some time at the end for a discussion. I want to end with an exercise and just a little bit of homework for you, because we remember things that don't quite come to a closure. So you're going to remember this best if you leave with a question, and I have a couple of questions for you, and I'll tell you more about why. So hope. Okay, we're going to talk about specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And first, let's look at transition niche coaching, at some of the specifics that you might think about in terms of what are you going to do with this. So I want to give you an example to think about parallels that may be of interest to you. Practicing professionals like healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise to solve special problems and give specific advice or do specific procedures. is backed by a number of things: professional standards, laws, codes, immense training. Even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, professionals may not have been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to deal with stress as an obstacle to their success, know how to practice mindfulness meditation, pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursued professional advancement, convert from work ethic to performance ethic, emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. I mean, I assumed until into my practice, I'd be doing that all of my life. Then I planned for an early retirement at 25 years and to make the transition to professional coaching, but that was later. Another genre, performance professionals, and we just heard, includes actors, professional athletes, artists. The primary challenge for these clients may be self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success. And an area that I've seen specifically is when people who are executives and business owners and pro athletes retire, they absolutely feel lost. I'll come back to that in just a minute. Here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths. The points are play immediately following a tense or really contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to need especially to be grounded and centered to get back in the zone, in the performance zone, for the next play. Winning big or losing big can be disruptive. Immense success is at least as hard, in my view, harder for many, many people to deal with than extreme challenges. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively, with full concentration. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important. Tomorrow's the next day. Your next career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything you've done before. Everything that you've worked hard for, it will stand alone on its own. Additional people who have significant challenges in dealing with the emotions and the internal model identity shifts of transition are ones whose process begins with a significant and often abrupt loss, job, significant relationship, disability, divorce. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in regulating states of mind and addressing significant changes of their life game plan, as well as a career game plan, perhaps, is important in itself. Then this task becomes as important because it affects all other aspects of someone's situation in life. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce is the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management and how the changes need to be treated as a business, not as a part of the emotional decision. The business aspect of the divorce is only about the business of the divorce, to not let emotional factors derail logic and judgment. Studies show how even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as a particular business. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. An example, a place that I see this, is in mentor coaching with family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company that he or she founded 36 years ago to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and functions. Now, another example here. I've done a series of retreats with a good buddy of mine called What's Next Exec. We've done it at his ranch. And he is a former, very senior executive with IBM who did a very early retirement, even faster out than I did with practicing, and formed a very successful consulting business. And some of the major people in the world seem. What we did was to recognize that there are a number of people who are CEOs or business owners or professionals who've done one thing all their life, and they don't know exactly what to do next. They have been in a structure or a situation, and they may not know how to, if they have been a CEO, they've never set and collected professional fees. They've never, you know, thought about what it takes for a website. They've never done consulting independently. So there were a number of things about creating their own structure, about especially the change in identity. And I want to come back to this. One of the two questions I want to ask you at the very end of this is the question that in the first couple of retreats, the majority of the people, after this was 2.5 days, came to me and said, that question was the most profound of the entire 2.5 days, and I'm still thinking about it, and I still don't know how to answer it, but I just want you to know how much it grabbed me, and I'm going to share that with you at the end. So retired is not an identity. It's the lack of one. It's the next job. So let's look and move back to our perspective now in mentor coaching. What do clients want from us? I would say the mentor coach and client become co-authors of a new story and co-create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus the new in an evolving new story. We're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching us what it's like to be him or her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that we can teach it back to the client out loud. So we must be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or our agenda get in the way at all. Although we inevitably listen from the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously empathically resonate to bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. Here's what I believe that our clients want from us as coaches, which, as you'll hear, is analogous to the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. I believe our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play, that we accept praise without embarrassment or deflection or needing it, certainly, so that we can give it back to its creator as self-statement, full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. In other words, to stick up for the part of the client they haven't lived into yet. To see at times a thought, a feeling, a behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from X-Files. I'm sticking to it, though. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in their at times compromised result, to see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process, to validate their intuition, to hope that we as the mentor coach will not be awkward or self-conscious or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion, full immersion in the process. The architecture of trust silently forms while we talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story as well. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that is left behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron put it really beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We, the client, and us as mentor coach, we are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, model in a way that facilitates optimum growth. The client has to know that we are 100% invested in their success. This bond, this immersion and understanding in the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. In most cases, the most, and it will make a difference for the rest of that client's life. As a kind of PS here, I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I have said to certain clients, well, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a very short period of time. Think about perhaps intervals of updates, maybe at least once a year, that can be beneficial for both coach and client, sort of like booster shots. Witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory or technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement, but the bottom line always is, does it work? Mentor coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, to strengths, to untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. And the client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. That's not easy. We have to remember that. It's a narcissistic injury to look at, there's maybe a better things to do something after you've done it all this time, plus the challenge of change itself. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. I think Hemingway captured this principle really succinctly when he wrote about the craft of writing. He said, write the truest sentence you know. So as we nudge a client to consider their relationships with themselves, to self-reflect, we wonder, sometimes out loud, let's look at your important storylines. How exactly are you taking care of yourself? I ask clients in the beginning assessment, how often they work out. And those of you who have done the New Life Story wellness training with me know I will gently nudge them if it's not 5 to 6 times a week, give them references about why there is scientific validation now. how are you honoring your needs and ideals? And, of course, that means you know specifically what they are. Your relationships. Or have you created something that now seems to be controlling you? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, to celebrate, to unfocus. So, I've distilled what I believe are the most important principles that focus on facilitating change in the coaching relationship. These are in your outline. One, each person's life story is created. Some of these are so simple, they almost don't need to be mentioned, but sometimes the most simple things defy recognition. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Remember the roadmap. Recognition, ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and planning. Two, understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which don't. And then, this is the essence of what we do in coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Three, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. Now, to say that a little bit of a different way, you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Four, distinguish what to change, what to accept, what to let go, what to enhance. Those four things. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go of what you can't determine anyhow, can result in significant effectiveness. Five, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. Questions are so powerful because it focuses the energy field of the brain to direct, to clarify, to illuminate, even at times to story bust. That's what we do, is to look at scripts, and sometimes we have to bust scripts, as we've talked before. Six, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain a new story. Remember the P of the roadmap. This is what makes change permanent. When someone transforms into a new and evolving model of how and who they are, their identity. Seven, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Our assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. By making explicit the assumptions, we can see which facilitate and which interfere. Eight, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. And this is a slightly different way of saying it, if someone's protesting change, they've already engaged it. Nine, small changes lead to big changes. This is something we do every day in coaching. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively in the next day. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue, specifically to take a step for progress. That initiates effectiveness and a model of mastery. 10. Solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to align a client's needs and ideals, to strategize to the goal, to get all of the client moving in the same direction. 11, a collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side looking at the same scene together. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. The fundamental model that is unique to what we do in mentor coaching that distinguishes it from all other professions is we do a collaborative model. We are co-creating a new story together. We're not telling somebody what to do. Now, those of you who have worked with me say, well, yeah, I remember you told me what to do a few times. Well, I won't deny that. But still, it's easier to talk about things for purposes of theory. It's a collaborative model. 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what is not will become evident and self-perpetuating. And again, don't be afraid to be simple. For example, a physician client who's completed the 26th grade may have forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated and downloaded of how they're going to work with their clients or their patients or their colleagues. And remember what we talked about conversational intelligence. The first words boot up a mindset. When that is collaborative, it boots up a mindset of connection mediated by oxytocin. It results in a very different kind of process. So I do want to come back to your wellness story. I mentioned that, you know, I will work that in. And this is important in change especially. A significant aspect of a change and transition process, I believe, is to build in a wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach will be different than if from the very beginning you know you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care, change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for the best maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. It's an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it consistently must be assessed. And wellness is not something that you begin to plan at age 65 or even age 50, but it's a choice you make every day that writes your wellness story. Now, our wellness story is the cumulative result of daily choices, and we are now in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. It's taken quite a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. So here's an application, and here's a reference, something to think about. The story that we engage with our bodies is one of two possibilities, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge Jr., who's devoted almost four decades of his professional life to wellness research as an internist in New York City, has written a perennial bestseller called Younger Next Year and the companion book Younger Next Year for Women. His research finds that 70% of aging is not aging but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old, and that we'll diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be largely decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. Another story And he's demonstrated this vividly, and I've become much aware of his work as we've collaborated. We shared a venue and have read each other's stuff, and I'll tell you, if we have time, the impact that this has had for me personally. Another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. The alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. The new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. He emphasizes 4 of those 6 days need to be serious aerobic exercise the rest of your life. Biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that kill you. Mortality falls with exercise. Of several thousand people surveyed, 3 things stood out above all others that prompted procrastination: exercise, nutritional plan, and retirement plan. Short-term desires trump long-term goals. Emotions rule. Now, think about it in this way. On the other hand, things like going to work every day, work duties, projects, assignments, they're responded to routinely and simply. It's a mindset. You don't have to think about it. So this suggests that a task like exercise be treated with the same mindset as work. With work, you don't get up each day and debate about whether you'll do it or whether you won't, whether you'll, you know, knock off the rest of this week and really get after it Tuesday next week, or just skip it, or feel virtuous if you do it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. In school, later in work, you show up. Whatever it is, it's an organizing force. Even full-time parenting, exercise can be the same mindset. Now, according to Lodge, daily exercise like work should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. So, now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer, you're not a dietitian, you're not giving directives, but you can listen and make informed recommendations, and how your client listens to information, and you're always free to challenge the choices or the trail of logic leading to them and to their fulfillment. Here's something for you to be aware of. And this is from Lodge's research and from a host of other studies condensed succinctly. Then I'll get on to something else, I promise. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is exactly what we do in professional coaching. Intellectual and emotional stimulation, it creates more complex brain structure. Specifically, the hippocampus is the part of the brain, it's in the midbrain, especially connected with 2 things, creativity and memory, more so than any other part of the brain. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And very recently, non-invasive human studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students have replicated these findings. The number of cells in the hippocampus in charge of memory and creativity increases by almost 100% with a stimulating environment and exercise. Another finding related: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis, the number of cells in the hippocampus, especially creating memory and creativity, decline with chronic stress. Now, here's a note. It's sort of a sidebar, but it's something to look two when we look at the future. And this is future self-identification. A study by Princeton psychologist Emily Pronin has found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money you put away toward retirement, is highly variable depending on how closely we identify with our future selves. What she's found is that people who can see themselves clearly into the future, like at 70 or 80, save significantly more money. Now, based on that, there is some incredible new research that does computer-enhanced aging, and including about financial decisions, but also when computer-enhanced aging is done, when people can actually see their future selves, they begin to save at about 3 times the rate for their retirement because they can envision a future self. And some very recent studies have shown when there is computer-enhanced progression of what it's going to look like if they keep smoking, what it's going to look like if they keep gaining 3 pounds a year. These have had remarkable impact because it concretizes the process. So when people showed a lesser activity in thinking about their current and future self, they tended to save less money, keep doing the things that they were doing without thinking about it. The conclusion of Pronin's study and the studies of computer enhancement out of Stanford, encouraging people to imagine themselves in the future might help them more. This may be something that we think about in coaching. So, I want to conclude in a couple of ways. Your story hides in plain sight. Think about the differences of people who lead a reactive life, where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week, who are always going to lose that final 5 pounds, or write that book. Whatever it is, that goal needs to remain elusive in order to maintain hope, because if someone lost that last 5 pounds, then they'd have to confront what it's not the answer for. What making double amount of what they make now is not the answer for. This is how I first got interested in the psychological aspects of money as a psychoanalyst way decades ago, are the people who achieved remarkable success and made their 5 or 10 or whatever, and then didn't up the ante to say, well, you know, once I get to 5 million, once I get to 10 million, and they say, you know, I don't think this is the answer. So through these seminars, we've talked about how someone else's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen collaboratively, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapter of their life and business stories. Think about these questions. If your story to this point, your story now, to this point were to be published as a book, what would be the title and subtitle? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what would that be? First thing you think of. This is for an appointment with yourself for some brainstorming time. Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? These are the 4 questions applied here. What aspects of your story do you want to leave out, let go as you move ahead? What events or process foreshadows your next success, already has foreshadowed? What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And what is your spiritual essence? Now remember, you don't have to be religious to have spiritual meaning and significance and purpose. So, I want to do this to ask you to look with me at life stages of success. And I want to capture these in a quote because I think they capture them better than a whole bunch more words. And I'm asking you to move with me beyond the wide-angle lens that we've taken off in here and looking at change and transition. This is to time-lapse photography, because success may mean different things at different points in adult life at each developmental phase. The first is from Ruby D, I Dream a World, about how it looks in a relationship. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within a marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. And here's a way of looking at individual success. This is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Think about how in working with your clients, they will get perhaps beyond where they had even imagined because we can only visualize from our own system. So, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. Figure out what's really important, what your purpose is, your why. Now, here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective, from one of my all-time favorite essayists, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, I'd like you to do a final exercise with me. I'd like you to get in a very comfortable place and totally relax your body. Be very aware of how fully and comfortably your seat is holding you. Take a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. As you take another deep breath in, just focus on the sensation of the air coming through your nostrils and breathe out any tension. Imagine now, with your eyes closed, imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have seen right now but didn't acknowledge? Looking back, what do you feel about your situation right now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risks that you should or shouldn't have taken? Now, keep your eyes closed and look very carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. remember, you always know more than you think. Now, gradually open your eyes. And refocus on our collaboration. There are a couple of questions that I want to ask you. And I'd like you to write down your first response. That's usually emotionally the most salient and the most honest, because you don't kick it up to your left brain to make it make sense or be logical or conscious or intellectual, but just write down your first response. First question. What's the one thing you don't understand about yourself that seems most important? First response, write it down. Second question. This has to be first response, not think about it, write it down, even read it later. What is your unlived life? That's the question that I just spontaneously ask the first group of people at the What's Next Exec Retreat, the CEOs, the business owners, the professionals, that so many said that really grabbed me because I had never thought about that. So just to think about. Okay, we're in discussion mode. We have a few minutes, if you'll manage the background noise. Thoughts, questions, reflections about what we've discussed or what you thought about.
Dave, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome.
I just wanted to ask if you would repeat that first question again.
What's the one thing you don't understand about yourself? Still to this day, you know, there's always something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is Amelia from New York.
Hey, welcome. Go ahead.
This is scary. Very frightening.
Well, good. And if you feel scared, confused, and perturbated, my work for today is done.
Absolutely. It's
That's exactly what we do with a client. We bust the script. If we agreed with everything, if we didn't perturbate, if we didn't challenge, if we didn't story bust, we wouldn't be much better. We wouldn't be any better than a really good bartender.
This is crazy. Yeah.
Okay.
Just look at my life. If I continue living the way I am, I'm not going to get to 90. Hello?
Okay. All right then. All right. That's good. That's great. You've already begun to think about it, to apply it, to question. So much of what we do as mentor coaches is to convert convert a period into a comma. And what else? No, to look at possibility opens new channels, creates new neuronal connections, and beginning of new pathways in the brain. It activates different parts of the brain. An aha moment, as we've talked before, creates three components of lighting up the brain on fMRI scan. Three different parts of the brain light up with an aha moment, a moment of insight, and someone is vaulted to a state that is more synthetic and integrative and creative. Someone thinking about a fact, an order, a directive, no part of the brain lights up. So this is often what we do in helping someone to look at things in a different way to create a collaborative and working alliance so that we can get away with saying whatever we need to say, so that we can, with absolute engagement and full immersion with the client, knowing exactly that we have totally their best interest at heart, we are totally dedicated to their success, so that we can get away with saying whatever we need to say, to perturbate, to challenge, to look at things, but always done in a collaborative model, always done together. You're in the same foxhole looking out on whatever's going on. So this is the collaborative model that is consistent throughout. I hope I've, although this has been a training, a presentation, and not a mentor coaching, I hope I've conveyed the importance of that to you, although it's been a model of presentation of material and information more so, but still to distill that process, I think, from it is your challenge now. So other thoughts, questions, comments? Thank you, both of you, for those.
I think this is Medea from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, hi.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you. So, I think you very clearly got across that, you know, being a mentor coach is definitely a collaborative thing. I think the challenge for me is how much leading do you do when you see that when the client is trying to recreate their story, and let's say it's just recreating, like we talked about, another version, and how much leading can you do, meaning how much can you try to give them the right answers if they are still coming up with the wrong solutions, because I'm very solution-focused, and so I tend to want to be like, well, you know, what if you tried this, or you should do this, and I feel like that's not what we're supposed to do in this, and I'm really trying to learn how to maybe pose things more in a question form so that they can think about and reflect if that would work for them versus me just giving them advice, because a lot of times people are like, well, I'm here because I don't know. You know what I mean?
I want to interrupt you, which is what I would do if you were my client, and I want to play back to you a couple of things to highlight it, to look at tweaking your model. I think you have the understanding of the model of collaboration, that the client develops his or her own story, but when you superimpose the right answer or the wrong answer, are telling the client what to do, then you've moved to your story as if yours is going to be better. Now, two things. One, it's not going to be because it's not the client's story, because you don't begin with where the client is. Remember that circle that we drew with the stick figure? That's the client in that circle. You have to get in that circle, join them.
Right.
And this is to everyone now. To resonate with a client in order to go someplace new. So whatever you've done, you may have to decenter from that to be in the client story, looking together with the client of developing that in the very best way possible. And there are a number of things that we do as mentor coaches, and this is a whole other conversation. In addition to asking powerful questions, that's a principle, but not a rule, and not to be rigidified into a rule. So there are times we collaborate, commiserate, Dutch uncle, give advice, but it's not from the position of I've got the right way and you've got the wrong way, but let's look together at considering some things in a brainstorming fashion about what may work. So I would say decenter from the right-wrong axis, because that probably will not be heard by a client in a way that's going to be useful. Because, first of all, whenever you present something to a client that's other than what their belief system is, remember that when they have a fact, a belief system, a way of doing things, that's an anatomical reality in their brain. If you present something else as maybe a right way or just a different way, then that's going to challenge their error detection mechanism, and they're going to say, that's not right. So
right.
It has to be done collaboratively. Change can occur, but it's gradual and it's internal. Remember, the teacher doesn't just suddenly present a new model and think it's going to overwrite the model that the students already have in their brains that's an anatomical reality. So that, too, is collaborative. I hope that sort of makes sense.
Okay, yes, thank you.
I'm eager to hear any other follow-up thoughts. We're out of time and we'll have to stop, and I want to respect that, but any follow-up thoughts?
Yes.
Questions?
I have one.
Very quickly, because we're out of time. Go ahead, please. And this is?
I think there were two of us talking. This is Ron Fisher in San Diego. I just wanted to add that I really liked your perspective on the wellness store. It's not really something that I had given as much thought to, but hearing kind of your explanation about that mindset and how it impacts other areas, the mind, body, and spirit was really refreshing. So just wanted to say I appreciated that.
Yeah, before I collaborated with Lodge, I worked out probably three times a week. But after that, I work out 6 days a week, and it's something that I don't find time for or debate about. It's just something I put in my schedule. If a client says, can you meet at 2 o'clock on Wednesdays? Well, that's the time every day I'm at the gym. You know, I'm on the treadmill when the market closes. But, you know, so
right.
It's not a possibility. It's part of what I do. So I don't have to find time. It's there. I don't have to find time for writing. It's there. I don't have to find time to work with clients. It's there, and we are always able to find a time that will work well for the client. So think about it in that kind of mindset. It's made a tremendous difference for me in terms of energy and well-being. I've joined, you know, my daughter in the Boston Marathon. I mean, it's made a big difference.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Was there another point? I mean, we'll go over. You guys can feel free to peel off, but I want to catch any questions, and we can add a few minutes if you want to voluntarily stay. Was there another question or comment?
This is Pamela. I just had a comment. This is Pamela.
Where are you, Pamela?
I'm in China.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you? I didn't recognize your voice.
I'm good.
Welcome.
How are you?
Okay.
Thank you. No, I was just wanting to tell you, this was a great class, because the reason I took it is because these last 3 years I have had some very big transitions in my life.
Yeah.
And this class has helped me settle in and be like, okay, what I'm feeling is normal. I just have to work through it. So I'm glad I took the class, and thank you for all the information that you shared.
Did it really help with your prior training, Pamela, that we've done?
Yes, because I do. I was like, okay, I can see how I can add it to my coaching. So I was like, okay, so yes.
Super. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Anything else anybody wants to talk about?
Do you have a sequel to this?
Say it again, please.
Do you have a continuation to this?
Let's continue for a few minutes if there's some other conversation or things that you'd like to talk about. What you got? Or any other questions you'd like to ask me?
Dave, I just want to say that statement about decay or growth, if that's not enough to make you work out, I don't know what would be.
All right, yes. get Lodge's book, Younger Next Year for Women.
I am.
You can read that on the Stairmaster.
Absolutely.
Okay. Other thoughts? Other questions?
This may be a very complex question. This is Brandy. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
But it sort of goes along with the question from Milwaukee in that how do we know whether you had mentioned, I want to say it was in the first or maybe the second class, that sometimes the client may want to not sit in, I call it no man's land. I'm not sure if you called it no man's land, but that area between the two stories, where they don't really want to sit there for too long, and they may prematurely try to come up with a new story.
Okay, I'm gonna interrupt you and help you be a better coach right now. Are you gonna play along with me?
Yep, I'll go with it.
Okay. condense your question to 10 words or less, and I'll tell you if we have time for the research behind that, but that's what we remember and retain. So every question you ask a client, ask it clearly, simply, briefly, 10 words or less, and you're going to have a better response from your client. So condense your question into 10 words or less, go.
How do we know if they're creating the new story prematurely?
Well, I've never thought about that question. If it's not authentic, or if they're trying to do too much too soon, or do you have any way, and again, in a very succinct way, to give an illustration? Can you in 10 or 12 words give an illustration of that?
I don't have an illustration of that.
Well, I think I'm thinking ahead too much.
I do, if I can chime in. I have an example with that client.
Give the example.
I'm sorry?
Give the example in 10 words or less.
So the client gets excited, like we were talking about earlier, and he comes up with a new story and a new idea, but it's not thought out and it's not realistic, but they get very excited about it because it looks more...
You, as the coach, interrupt the client if that's the case. You're collaborating about the client's goal. If it's a smart goal, if it's specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, time-bound, and you are a collaborative partner in that to look at their goal and to help them convert it into a smart goal. You also have an awareness of their needs and their ideals, so that is this consistent with who they are and who they want to become? Is it a story that is next needing to be developed? So you develop a strategy and a way to do that in a stepwise way that shrinks the change, so that they know tomorrow what they're going to do. Because what looks like resistance can sometimes be simply not knowing what the next step is, or having it too vague or too abstract or too many words.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a feeling it had to do with the same thing as the self-esteem, that it, as long as it goes along with their ideals, it will work out. It's just hammering out the steps.
It will work if you work it. If you collaboratively move toward that goal, then it can be attained step by step, but you have to know what each step is. Remember Terry Fox, he just went to the next telephone pole, but he knew where that line of telephone poles went, 3,339 miles across to the end of the Marathon of Hope. So you got to know where you're going in order to make the next step count. Because when you have a map, again, as we talked before, when you have a map, you can tell specifically where you are, where you're going, you can measure progress along the way, and you can tell what's detour and what's distraction. But think seriously about the simple task in collaboration with a client about how you ask a question. The three basic stories, the three basic components of good stories: clarity, brevity, simplicity. Same for a good question. That's what we retain, 10 words or less, from neuroscience studies. That's what we know now. So make a question brief, clear, and simple, and then stop and let your client take over. Don't do multiple choice elaborations or subtly try to sneak in the answer that you think it ought to be. And then it will be much more meaningful and clear for the client. Because they want to think about the times you've been at a presentation or read a paper. There's just so many words, you just have to work at finding the meaning, and you use up some of your mental energy doing that. So what do? You start planning what you're going to have for dinner that night, or you vote with your feet and leave, or put down the paper. And the presenter or the writer never knows why suggestions weren't followed, but it just, somebody checked out. Clients check out if you're too wordy. And one of the ways I've known this, I've been, I met my wife, we married 14 years ago at a writer's conference. And one of the first times that, you know, we started, you know, we lived in different cities and we spent some time on the phone. And she said in the very nicest way somebody has ever said to me that I talk too much. She said, "Dave, you have an amazing tolerance for syllables." So, and it took a long time to really get that. And you wouldn't know it from this presentation. But, well, thank you all very much. Thank you for all the input and all the kind words. I hope this has been helpful. I'll be eager to hear from you. Let me know how things go, and I hope we cross paths again. Thanks.
Dave, do you send emails if you're doing your next presentation, or do we have to check it out on the website? Or do you send anything when the next one comes?
I will put you guys on the mailing list. I can send that permission right.
Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dave.
I appreciate it. Hey.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
I'm done. We did pretty well here, you know, with signals and stuff while I was in the middle of a conference there.
I think that you need to get rid of Facebook. This is terrible. People are arguing with each other over the new trade agreement, the new trade thing. And listen to what they say to each other.
What happened to me?
Well, the new trade is that